Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And today on Weird House Cinema, we're going to be talking about the 1962 fantasy adventure, The Magic Sword, starring Basil Rathbone, directed by Burt I. Gordon, the director of another film we've covered on Weird House Cinema, at least one other. Gordon was the director of Attack of the Puppet People, also known as Mr. Big, B-I-G, his initials. He was well known for shrinking and blowing up things in his movies, either making little things big or making big things little. And we get some of both in this one.
That's right. One of the things about The Magic Sword from 1962 here is that it is a special effects spectacular. You're going to there's so many special effects coming at you, some of them very noticeable and others you can easily take for granted, especially today, where, various things like, for instance, the magic mirror that we see in the movie, it's an impressive special effect. And it's one of just many, many special effects that are used to create this magical world of love and happiness, but also horror and mutilation.
Now, Burt I. Gordon was well known for making sort of low-budget B-grade movies that a lot of people would call hack, but are in many ways quite enjoyable. The King Dinosaur and stuff like mm-hmm. that, movies that ended up on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
As did this one.
I've actually never seen that episode, but this, from what I understand, is widely regarded as one of his best movies, and I can see why. It still has some of the hallmarks of his other stuff. Like, it has some, I would say, texturally or tonally inappropriate special effects that actually mm-hmm. do look pretty good, but they don't fit the vibe of the movie. Like, the movie is ostensibly, sort of a fun magical adventure, almost maybe aimed at a younger audience, aimed at kids, but it also has just absolutely unnerving, almost perverse gore in it.
Yeah, I would compare it in a way to Peter Jackson's King Kong in that respect, movie made by, a consummate pro, somebody that also had a lot of experience with the special effects, creating a film that is aimed at a very wide audience, very mainstream audience, but ends up having some moments of just extreme horror. Or, well, I don't know. In the case of The Magic Sword, it might be a bit much to say extreme horror, but still horror that does seem maybe a little out of pace with the rest of the picture, and seems to have been out of pace at the time. I mean, there were some seemingly strong reactions to this. I was reading that upon initial release, the British Film Board gave it an X rating. They were like, no, we're not having any of this. And later, some things get adjusted and it comes out.
It's kind of like if you imagine Disney's The Sword and the Stone, but if it included a lot of close-ups of knights being melted by acid and radiation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, and in that, you know, radiation is a hallmark of other Bird Eye Gordon pictures, and that element is at least visually present in this, though nobody's calling it radiation.
But another one of the things that I would single out this movie for is it has some deliciously hammy performances, especially the ones from Estelle Winwood and Basil Rathbone as the two main sorcerers in the movie. They are hamming it up. It's some all-time ham here.
Yeah, a lot of other Bird Eye Gordon films don't necessarily have as strong of human performances. And this is a film that really has the human special effects, at least in a couple of roles, to match up with the actual special effects. So yeah, I think it is a really solid, enjoyable picture. And it is often cited as one of Bird Eye Gordon's best.
Now I'm trying to think, have we done another high fantasy movie on Weird House with like knights and wizards and stuff like that? Is the closest we've come to that Krull?
Oh, well, I mean, we did Krull. I mean, you could also think of another sword. You could think of a Thrilling Bloody Sword, though that's a little bit different. We, of course, did Conquest. I imagine I'm forgetting one or two. But, you know, we do touch in on the epic fantasy of different shades now and again.
Yeah, I guess all of those have elements of this. So I would say that all of the weird, grotesque texture aside, which makes this movie wonderful, just in terms of straight plot content, this is the most down-the-middle high fantasy we've done.
And yet there are a number of just real bonkers elements to it that are going to be fun to get into. Like just in terms of like the textures are all sort of traditional mainstream fantasy. But some of the things that the screenplay does with it, I ended up really admiring. All right. So what would your elevator pitch be for The Magic Sword?
Oh, can I not do Sword in the Stone, but with radiation melting? I guess we already said that. Let's see.
No, that one's solid. We can stick with it. Stick with what works.
Let me try another one. Let's see. George, an adventurous young lad of only 20 years old, it's debatable in the movie whether he is supposed to be understood as a child or not at the age of 20. He falls in love with a princess without ever having met her. He just like observes her through magical TVs of various sorts. Then she is kidnapped by a wizard and he must come to her rescue and brave seven perils and curses along the way. And it's going to be gross.
The curses are all amazing. The titular magic sword is probably the fakest looking thing in the whole picture.
Yeah.
So it is kind of weird that like that's the selling point. And the poster says the most incredible weapon ever wielded.
This is funny because it does not look incredible. It's one of the least good props and effects in the movie. It looks very flimsy, very plastic. It's the sword is kind of lame.
Its special power is set manipulation.
Yes.
And it fails halfway through the picture.
Yeah. That is funny. It has the power to open doors. Wow. Mm-hmm. But you know what I do like? I like a version of the sword that completely misrepresents what it's like in the movie. I think it's either the Italian or the Spanish poster for the movie, La Spada Magica, which that makes the sword look really cool.
Oh, yeah, it's glowing. I don't think it ever really glows like this. And you also have a great image, a great drawing of Basil Rathbone as Lodak in the background, looming large.
All right, should we do some trailer audio?
Let's do that trailer audio.
I am Sir George, possessor of the magic sword. By its powers, I will lead you on the seven great adventures, each one mightier than the other. Together we will go where no man has ever gone, into the land of terror itself, where the Superman of evil is king.
Let no man face my seven curses and reach the dragon's lair.
Together we will dare the demons of the green flame. See the white-hot face of the fiery rock. Enter the mammoth cave that closes behind you, where humans are trapped and tombed. Brave the volcanic inferno of the boiling crater. See the miracle of the magic sword. Battle the gigantic ogre. You'll be thrilled to the hilt by the magic sword. None like it since the world began. A 2,000-year-old legend Hollywood waited until now to tell. The magic sword.
All right. So you might be wondering at this point, well, where can I watch The Magic Sword? Well, it is at first glance widely available. You can find the MST3K version. I think Rift Tracks did a version of it. Usual caveats on Rift content. You know, it's like it can be a lot of fun and so forth. But you are going to lose some scenes, especially in the MST3K episodes. And I have to say, even though this one looks like it's streaming everywhere, I initially like marked it to stream on a Prime channel. I went and queued it up, started watching it. Terrible quality. Mm-hmm. I ended up having to watch it kind of like last minute. I found a YouTube stream that was in higher def. And so I have to say my main recommendation for watching The Magic Sword is, yeah, make sure you watch it in as good a quality as possible. Because again, this is a special effects film. And if you watch it in high def, it looks really nice. It has some wonderful colors and textures to it. And that's just lost in the degraded version. I would recommend grabbing it on physical media. KL Studio Classics put it out on Blu-ray. I think that's probably the way to watch it. If you can find an official stream that's good quality, great, but it looks like a lot of them are not.
Yeah, I agree. There are a lot of cruddy rips out there.
All right, well, let's get into the cast and crew here, or some of the highlights of the cast and crew. As usual, we can't highlight everybody that made the picture happen. But yeah, starting at the top, Bird Eye Gordon, director, producer, story credit, special visual effects, along with his wife, I believe. And he lived 1922 through 2023. The legendary Mr. Big, as we've been saying, an icon of 1950s B-cinema. His earliest credit is producer on 54 Serpent Island, and he moved on into the director's chair and the writing chair with his follow-up, 55's King Dinosaur. We talked about him at greater length in our episode on the 58 film Attack of the Puppet People. Other films of note include The Amazing Colossal Man from 1957 that I think we absolutely will do if we get a proper release of it and I can watch it in decent quality.
Yeah.
Earth versus the Spider from 58, Village of the Giants from 65, and Empire of the Ants from 77.
Did we ever figure out what's going on with the rights to Amazing Colossal Man? Like, why is there not a good Blu-ray of that?
I don't know the answer. I haven't checked in recently on it either. So it's entirely possible something's been announced and I haven't missed it. I try and pay attention to the various channels and so forth that would announce this sort of thing. But sometimes it slips through. I have no idea. Like, Amazing Colossal Man is such a tremendously fun movie that it needs to have a proper Blu-ray release, and I don't know what's holding that back. Far lesser films are getting elaborate Blu-ray releases.
Agreed. And I do want to emphasize again, I sort of said this up top, but despite Bird Eye Gordon's reputation and the dullness of some of his other movies, this one is, I would say, this is a well-made film. Like, it just, it's got energy. It just zips right along and it's fun. Even if you're not in it for the weirdness of the textures the way that we are, I think you're probably not going to be bored by this one.
Yeah, the plot moves right along. And yeah, we have to give credit, screenplay credit, to Bernard C. Schoenfeld, who lived 1907 through 1990. American screenwriter. His first screen credits date back to 1944's Phantom Lady. His other credits include 58's The Space Children. That was one directed by Jack Arnold, who we've talked about on the show before. Mm-hmm. And he did a lot of TV work, including 16 episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and one episode of The Twilight Zone from Agnes with Love, about a computer technician who begins to take advice from a computer that he has fallen in love with.
Wait, is that the original Twilight Zone?
Oh, that's original. Yeah. Yeah. I should stress that, because I know there have been like three or four different iterations of the Twilight Zone at this point, but this was original Twilight Zone. And also original Alfred Hitchcock Presents, because there were at least two different versions of that as well.
I guess I didn't realize they were doing Fall in Love with Computer stories back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the various sci-fi writers and horror writers of the time, like, you know, a lot of that stuff was, it still holds up today, at least from a you know, a plot and script standpoint.
Yeah.
So yeah, on the whole, I love the weird energy and the interwoven schemes in this picture. We'll get into all that. Mm-hmm. Again, it depends on a lot of the textures of traditional old-timey fantasy films and likely swashbuckling fantasies as well that I'm just not that up on. But the plotting feels pretty fresh and at times really bonkers.
It does bring just like warm jets of zaniness that just keep coming in anew. There are multiple things in the movie that, you know, I almost kind of wonder if they were actually in the script or if it was in the original draft of the script or if it was just like Bird Eye Gordon, Floor Gordon saying, we can do this kind of effect. What if we had some people trapped in a tiny cage? What if we had this or that? And they just wanted to show it to you. So here it is.
Yeah, and this is the guy who figured out how to weave all that together into a coherent plot. Because, yeah, it has like all of these things. Like, it seems like he maybe had a checklist to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, we've already done Attack of the Puppet People. Let's just put some puppet people in there.
Puppet people, giants of some sort. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into the cast here. As we mentioned, we have the wonderful Basil Rathbone in this, playing the evil and vain wizard Lodak. We talked about Rathbone before. He lived 1892 through 1967. A South African-born English actor with a very long history on stage and screen. He popped up in 66 as Queen of Blood. But I have to say, he was in it, but very forgettable because it's difficult to compare that Basil Rathbone to this Basil Rathbone because we get like full-powered, hamming it up. Basil Rathbone in this picture, and what we saw in Queen of Blood was a lot more subdued.
I truly did not remember he was in that. I remember Dennis Hopper more than him.
Yeah. I think it was one of those pictures where Rathbone did his stuff in like one or two days. He was just ultimately a very small role in the picture. But in this, I mean, he's in almost every scene.
He's in some scenes he's not in this.
Yeah. Yeah, his energy resonates through the picture. But I'm not going to get into all the details. But yeah, he started appearing in films during the early 20s, often in swashbucklers, always buckling that swash. He stayed active on stage, won a Tony Award in 1948, and he was nominated for two Oscars, I believe 1939's If I Were King and a 1937 adaptation of Romeo and Juliet. He also, of course, had a big footprint in horror and detective series. He played Sherlock Holmes multiple times, and he played Baron von Wolf in 1939's Son of Frankenstein, the third Universal Frankenstein film with Karloff and Bela Lugosi.
I feel like Rathbone was sort of on the second tier of the great horror stars. If you have like Karloff and Lugosi at the very top, the level under that is where Rathbone hangs out.
Yeah. So, yeah, tremendous talent. And again, we get to see him, you know, firing on all cylinders in this picture. Very energetic performance, captivating. And also, something that I think is always admirable when you have an actor of this caliber is that he does seem to bring a little extra out of the other players in their shared scenes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In every scene he's in, it feels like the other actors are having fun with him.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I would say some of the most fun we have is when he has interactions with our next actor, and that's Estelle Winwood, who plays Sybil, the witch foster mother of our hero, Sir George.
She has her own kind of excellent hamminess. So mm-hmm. Rathbone's hamminess is, yeah, like you said, he's this arrogant, vain, pompous wizard who's just like can't stand to have his ego pricked. Meanwhile, Estelle Winwood's sorceress is, she's like very checked out. She's almost like half of her brain is not on this plane of existence.
Yeah, well, she's been raising this 20-year-old boy all by herself. She doesn't get a lot of help from the chimpanzee or the conjoined twins, two-headed. I'm not sure exactly what's going on with that character, but these folks are not helping her out a lot around the house. And clearly, as we'll discuss, Sir George is a lot to handle. And so she doesn't have her head in her schemes all the time. And it's also established early on, like, she's not the best witch or wizard in the world. Lodak is a towering figure, And she rates, you know, a good bit down the list. But still, she's a good witch, ultimately. But she's not afraid to get her hands a little dirty.
That's right. Unlike Lodak, she has the power of love in her corner.
That's right. So Estelle Winwood lived 1883 through 1984. English actress of stage, screen, and TV who had a very long and celebrated history career here in the U.S. She made her Broadway debut in 1916 and her first film roles in the early 1930s. But some of her biggest and most memorable films were from the 50s and 60s, including 1959's Darby O'Gill and The Little People. She plays the mom of the town bully, Pony, who, of course, gets into at least a couple of punch-ups with Sean Connery.
I've never seen that.
Oh, it's tremendous fun. I mean, Estelle was great in it, and then everyone else is great in it. It's just a really fun, you know, old-timey Irish fantasy film.
You've brought it up before as the, I think in the context of being a pre-Bond Sean Connery.
Yeah, yeah. I highly recommend it. It's great St. Patrick's Day viewing, in my opinion. Or at least, you know, I grew up watching it on St. Patrick's Day anyway.
Okay, I'll have to see it sometime.
But Winwood was also in 1964's Dead Ringer, 67's Camelot, as well as The Producers, both two huge films in 67. And her final film role was in 1976's Murder by Death. Like I said, when it comes down to interactions between Sybil and Lodak, they're so much fun. Even when they're not actually in the same space at the same time, they have a wonderfully spicy interaction just via closed-circuit magic mirror at one point.
Yeah, exactly. Despite the fact that, I mean, this is a silly movie and it's hard to get too wrapped up in the, you know, in the battle of good and evil and the plot here. But nevertheless, I did find her defeat of Lodak at the end of the movie very satisfying.
Yes, absolutely. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, let's move on to Sir George, who, again, Sybil has been raising as her foster son, played by Gary Lockwood, born 1937, a former stuntman and stand-in for Anthony Perkins. He's probably best remembered as Dr. Frank Poole in 1968's 2001, A Space Odyssey. You know, we've talked before about actors from 2001, A Space Odyssey, kind of like classing up the joint in pictures. We talked about that in Gorgo, right? I don't know. I don't quite get the same effect with Lockwood's presence here. This one, man, he plays a real goober, a lovable goober, and a young boy of 20. He was actually, I think, 24 or 25 when they filmed it.
So old.
Yeah. And then there are other weird, we'll get into some of the other weird aspects about his character, like his, yeah. What sort of home environment he has here in this witch's lair.
I mean, it's weird, but it's kind of sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. He's sweet. He's sweet. Anyway, Lockwood had a memorable guest role in the third episode of Star Trek, the original Star Trek, the episode Where No Man Has Gone Before from 1966. I believe he's a crew member who gets possessed by an alien force. His other credits include 61 Splendor in the Grass, the 1963 Elvis movie It Happened at the World's Fair, 1969's Model Shop, and 1995's Night of the Scarecrow.
Ugh.
He was also in the 1961 Elvis movie Wild in the Country.
Wait, what happened at the World's Fair?
It?
What was it?
I don't know. I meant to reach out to my aunt, who's an expert on all these Elvis movies, and ask her about these two and find out if these are good ones or not, because I had not heard of either of them, but I didn't get the chance to reach out to her. So I have to pick up the thread on that in listener mail.
I'm just going to choose to believe the Elvis movie It Happened at the World's Fair is about the H.H. Holmes murders.
Yeah, I'm sure that's it. All right, we've been talking about Sir George. Of course, he's fallen in love with the princess. The princess is Princess Elaine, played by Anne Hilm. Born 1938, her biggest film was probably the 1962 Elvis movie. Again, Follow That Dream. And I cannot tell you what the dream in question is, but this is a movie about following it. She's also in the 1969 horror film Nightmare in Wax, starring Cameron Mitchell as the Mad Wax Master. This one I have seen. This is how my movie viewing history tends to go.
I think we talked about this one in our episode on wax. Well, we did an episode on like the science of wax, but then also talked about wax horror movies.
Yeah, this is one that feels very grimy and sweaty. I remember a lot of close-ups of Cameron Mitchell's face looking kind of sweaty.
He's got an eye patch in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the one where he has an eye patch. Not the best wax movie, but still very much an important entry in the Wax Master franchise.
It's hard to beat Vincent Price's House of Wax.
Yeah, no, that's the absolute best.
Now, maybe we should save this for later, but I just want to say it now so I don't forget. I feel like we should do a compare and contrast on Vincent Price versus Basil Rathbone, because I feel like they have a lot of qualities, but also some hard to define differences that are nevertheless important.
I feel like Vincent Price was better at conveying kind of like the internal mechanisms of his scheming, you know, whereas Rathbone, especially in this, there is a sense that he's not considering you much at all. Like his enemies, he's very dismissive of their abilities. You know, that's his level of vanity and arrogance, at least as he plays it up in this character. And I feel like in, you know, certainly Vincent Price could play some vain and evil characters, but there was always a sense that no, he wasn't underestimating you per se. He was thinking long and hard about your various strengths and weaknesses.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's very astute. I would say if Vincent Price had been in this role, I think he would have played it a little bit colder, and you would have seen him taking the stock of George and his allies more than just kind of batting at them like a gnat that's bothering him.
Yeah, he would have seen Sybil as more of a rival and not as an aunt. He seems to see everyone as just mere pieces on the chessboard.
Oh, but hey, Basil Rathbone is not the only bad guy in this movie. We actually get multiple hammy villains.
That's right. We have Sir Branton, who is a romantic rival for the princess's heart and a seemingly brave knight at first, but we get a series of twists that reveal that no, he's not here to make friends. He's not here to play fair. He'll do whatever it takes.
He's here to kick you in the acid.
Yes, kick you in the butt, make you fall in the acid. Played by Liam Sullivan, who lived 1923 through 1998. Yeah, very, very fun character. And the performance here provides, I think, a nice dry counterpoint to Lodak. You know, like, you're not going to have, you can't have two villains that are going for that level of hammed up villainry. This is the right level for your secondary villain.
Yeah, I guess you're right about that. I did identify him also as a hammy performance, but it's in a different way than Basil Rathbone, not at the same level, and it has a different quality. It's more kind of sneering. It has a sneering, snidely whiplashiness to it.
Yeah, still solid villainy for sure. Sullivan was an American actor of TV and film. I'd say mostly TV. He did episodes of Star Trek, original, Twilight Zone, original, Man from U.N.C.L.E., and his film credits include 65's That Darn Cat, 84's What Waits Below, and the 1986 film Wisdom. All right, the next character is credited as Mignonette. I don't remember if they call her this in the film. She's a seducer, a witch, some sort of a hag creature.
The false magical mask of a witch that is used to seduce a knight who is French. And they explain this in the plot. They're like, well, he's French, you know, so he's into pretty ladies. So she is the pretty lady form of the evil witch who wants to bite his neck and I don't know, drink his blood, maybe. I'm not sure.
Blood there for sure. Yeah. And she falls into some of the other schemes of Lodak, as we see. But she's played by Danielle de Metz, born 1938. French-born actress who worked in American film and television. She appeared in 1959's Return of the Fly, which, you know, if you haven't seen, you might remember from the Misfits song. And she had a small part in Blake Edwards' 1968 film, The Party, mostly active in the 60s and 70s. She was nominated for an Emmy for a special guest part on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. in 1964.
I don't believe I've seen Return of the Fly. Does she become a fly?
I don't know. I haven't seen it either. I've just seen stills in which a fly-headed man is approaching her and she is screaming.
Well, I
would. So I don't know if she's like the main heroine of the picture or if she's just like an early victim. I'm not entirely certain, but there are a number of stills of her in the picture.
Nobody likes to get cornered by a fly-head guy at a party.
No, absolutely not. All right, and then finally, the score is by Richard Markowitz, who lived 1926 through 1994, Emmy-nominated composer, best known for his work on such TV shows as Murder, She Wrote, Mission Impossible, though I do need to stress that he did not write the theme music for either of these series. He's the father of singer Kate Markowitz, who also worked as a backup singer for such artists as James Taylor, Randy Newman, Katie Lang, and Warren Zevon. Her 2003 solo album was Map of the World. But as far as Richard Markowitz's work goes, there are plenty of places in this score that are very traditional, highlighting either like the sweeping mainstream drama of the thing or some nutty hijinks, nutty magical hijinks. But it also gets weird and, I believe, electronic at times. There's some nice suspense in a later cave scene, and there's this wonderful Sybil is Cooking sequence that features an absolutely bonkers track full of bleeps and bloops and monster croaking. It's fabulous.
Yeah, there's a nice mix of things. So in the traditional end, we've got the the King of the Castle horns, bum 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 bum, kind of stuff. And then we've also, in the funny scenes, we've got plenty of doom dee doom dee doom. but I know what you're talking about with the experimental moments. I liked those parts.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's jump into the plot of The Magic Sword.
All right. Well, after the credits are pretty straightforward. They're like red credits playing over a painted backdrop that looks like St. George slaying the dragon, which I suppose is loosely the inspiration for this movie, but I would place emphasis on loosely. Mm-hmm. The action opens with a shot of a witch's lair. So there's a bubbling cauldron and a table with a polished human skull as a centerpiece, and it's all saturated in red light. This movie really likes the red gel lights, especially in Sybil's sort of fortress of magic.
Oh, yeah. She has so many red gels going in there. It's like a dark room. You would think that she's developing an Eastman Kodak film in there or something.
So we pan up and we meet Estelle Winwood as Sybil the Sorceress. She's wearing kind of a sorceress dress with like the big dangly open sleeves, and she's got jewels around her neck and all that. She looks very magical, and she's talking to herself. She says, "He's gone again. What good is my sorcery if I can't help my own boy? Answer me, someone." So, like, who's there to answer? Well, we're going to pan around the room and see. First of all, we've got a chimpanzee dressed in a red tunic and a leather belt who's sitting at a chair at the dinner table here. He has no input. He's just sitting there scratching his head. And then Sybil says, "He's not fooling me. I know where he is. He's at the magic pool again." Now, commenting on that, we suddenly hear from Sybil's other, I don't know, like her coworker or friend or helper here, which is a two-headed man whose two heads say simultaneously, "Love is his curse. He is in love." Now, one thing I noticed about the two-headed man here is that the way that the two heads here, they behave in a way that sort of defeats the purpose of imagining this creature with two heads, because they always say the exact same thing at the exact same time in unison.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I assume that they've just worked together for a very long time, and they've had to come together in agreement on a number of things here, because we don't know the origin of this character or characters. I mean, she might have made them through her sorcery at some point or another.
I guess so, yeah. Sybil says, "Yes, I've tried to cure him of this love. Why have I failed? Am I losing my skill as a sorceress? Doesn't my witchcraft cure snake bites, chilblains, carbuncles, pink eye, hangnails, and unhappy memories?" And I'd love to imagine who is coming to Sybil's like red witch cave and the chimpanzee and saying, "I have pink eye."
I feel like the movie kind of like cut to the chimp when she said pink eye. And it was like implied that like this chimp is just getting pink eye like crazy. It's like every week having to cure this chimp of pink eye.
But her two-headed friend here assures her, yes, her powers are still strong. So why can't she cure her son George of his love infection? She sort of argues with the two-headed guy about this. They say George is a man and he's human, so, you know, he's going to fall in love. But she says, he is not a man. He is only 20 years old, which means he is still a child. She obviously does not approve of his decision to grow up. At first, I didn't understand what this whole thing about like her repeatedly asserting that a 20-year-old is a child. But I think it's because she is an immortal sorceress who is, I think she says 420 years old. So compared to that lifespan, it's like, oh, yeah, he is a child.
Yeah, yeah. He should not get the keys to the car until he's like at least 65.
So meanwhile, we go to meet George at the magic pool that Sybil was talking about. So he's leaning over the water's edge, the water's bubbling, and he starts begging the water to show him the princess. So first we see a castle, and then we cut inside the castle to the throne room where, like, the whole court, the king is sitting there on the throne holding his scepter, wearing his crown, and then everybody in the court is gathered, and they're just watching a belly dancer perform.
Yeah.
Nothing going. Princess is not there. Everybody's just like, you know, good show. Good.
I mean, he apparently spends a lot of time just watching, spying on the castle so that he can see the princess that he's in love with.
Yeah.
This is our first hint at like the idea that George's whole upbringing is just weird. Like he's grown up in this magical crypt. He has access to all of this, privacy, defying magical pools and mirrors and so forth, and then gets fixated on people he's never met.
That's right. And the privacy violations get worse because he's like, all right, she's not in the throne room. Show me the pond in the palace garden where that is where she is. In fact, she's bathing in the pond there with her lady in waiting hanging out, and like, dude, respect the princess's privacy, please. But, you know, he's just watching.
Yeah.
So this is Princess Helene. She gets out and starts talking to her lady in waiting. And she's talking about how she's upset with her situation in life. She's like, you know, even though I'm a princess, I'm unhappy because I'm not allowed to fall in love. Essentially, she can't even speak to a man. She can't meet people or talk to them. She's sort of like kept away apart from the world in a tower. And she tells her lady in waiting, quote, "You can do whatever you please. Fall in love, fall out again, a squire one day, a stable boy the next." And the lady in waiting does not take offense to this. She's like, it's the cost of being a princess. But suddenly a voice calls out. Ooh, it's like a ghostly, otherworldly voice. It says, Princess Helene. And she looks around and then sees a kind of insubstantial figure moving toward her. It's like the figure of a lady with a green veil over her head, some kind of fairy-like queen. And this lady is coming toward her and she says, Princess, I'm going to take care of you. And then her eyes flash green. And I don't think we ever see this lady again, do we? I have no idea who she is.
Yeah, I mean, presumably it is some sort of agent of Lodak, but not someone that is named or featured later. This is also a great scene where the ghost is coming right at the camera, right out at the audience. And there are a number of moments like this in the picture, because again, this is all about special effects. It's about thrilling the audience. And so Bert's coming right at you.
This movie would have been a great candidate for 3D. I mean, I'm kind of glad it's not 3D because I enjoy it in the 2D format, but it has a lot of stuff coming at you. It could have been a 3D option.
For sure.
So anyway, George witnesses this magical fairy abduction of the princess through his magical spy pool. He jumps up and he shouts, Helene! Then he runs back home to Sybil and explains that the princess is in danger and he's got to go rescue her at once. But Sybil is very dismissive of this. Her points are the following. You're only a boy. You're not old enough to be in love. You can't be in love with somebody you only saw in a magic pool and have never met. That's a good point.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also just basically like, love is silly. But for, I guess they're like, well, we'll get some more information. So she takes George over to her magic mirror, which is yet another long-range magical surveillance device. This had me wondering, wait, why did George have to go use the magic pool if they've got magic mirror at home?
I guess it's like sometimes, you have like two TVs in the household, perhaps so the dad can watch football and the kids can watch cartoons. It's like she has witching stuff she needs to do. She can't have George in the way spying on princesses the whole time.
She's got to call into her sorceress Zoom meetings.
Yeah.
So Sybil tunes into throne room TV and she sees the king, presumably done with his belly dancing session. He's talking to his court about his daughter's disappearance. Now, in this scene, we're going to meet a couple of other major characters, Sir Branton and Lodak. Sir Branton, we meet first. He is this haughty, arrogant, goateed knight wearing a blue tunic with a blazing sun emblem over the top of his mail. And he explains to the king that Princess Helene cannot be found anywhere. And while they're in the middle of discussing what to do, suddenly a palace guard enters the throne room, escorting Basil Rathbone. Basil Rathbone here is dressed in a black sorcerer's robe with a golden dagger at his belt. He's got a giant jewel-encrusted pendant on his chest. He's wearing a red and silver cloak with almost Santa Claus-y implications. He's also wearing some kind of wound cloth head covering. I don't know if this technically is a turban or is supposed to be a turban or if it's something else. Everything he's wearing pretty much has gold trim on it, and he just looks really smug.
Oh, yeah. Very smug, very colorful. It's a fabulous presentation and just absolute confidence oozing off of him here.
And the guard is like, we found him skulking on the castle grounds. He won't speak. And Sir Branton says, there are means to make him speak. So I love that Branton is going straight to suggesting torture with no information whatsoever on this guy. But also, look at him. This guy is going to speak. You can look at him and know he's about to speak. You don't need to worry about him not speaking.
Also, I'm going to have to ding the script here, or at least the way the script was performed, because this is not a character that has ever skulked in his life. He is no skulker. I think you mean to say vainly awaiting his audience with the king.
Yeah, skulking, I think, requires a downturned angle of the head. Like, the head is sort of down, but this guy's chin has never even, been parallel with the ground.
Right.
So Basil raises his arms up. He stirs up some kind of magic. The lights go dim. Thunder cracks. And he says, Your most serene majesty, you can call off the search. The princess, your daughter, is in my castle under lock and key. So the king demands to know who this sorcerer is, and he answers, Lodak. So they know who this is. They know him by reputation. He is a bad sorcerer.
Yeah, and it's not Lodak the Great, Lodak the Terrible. Just all you need to know is Lodak. It's great branding.
I don't know why, but I always imagined Lodak's name when I heard it here as an acronym. Like, it's all capital letters. I don't know what it stands for.
Well, I mean, Lord of Damnation and, I don't know, pick a C word, and you got it, I think.
So they ask him, you know, why did you kidnap the princess? And Lodak says, this is the quote, "The answer is very simple. Your father executed my sister for witchcraft when she was only 18 years old. I have waited until your daughter reached that age so that my dragon could relish the flesh of the princess." Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's very simple. It's moderately simple, I guess. So Lodak has a dragon. He's going to feed the princess to the dragon to get revenge on the king's family, or so he says.
Yeah, and I don't even know if we should believe him because this never comes up again. He doesn't seem to be dwelling on this too much. And Lodak doesn't seem like a sentimental type.
Yeah, it seems like if some king executed his sister for witchcraft, he'd be like, shouldn't have gotten caught. But in reaction to this, Sir Branton, he's coming out hot. He says, "I'm not afraid of some worm-eaten sorcerer. I'll come straight to your castle and rescue the princess." But then Lodak warns them all. He says, "Look, it's not hard to find my castle. It's right down the road. It's a week's journey from here. But between here and there, you'll have to face Lodak's original recipe of 7 signature curses. No one has ever passed through all 7 curses and survived." Then he explains that his dragon is going to eat the princess in 7 days' time, and he starts to show himself the door. By the way, he turns and starts walking toward the door, toward the camera, with his arms just raised up in the air. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly he changes course and then turns into a crow and flies away. That had me laughing out loud.
It's so showy. It's wonderful.
Also, right after this, I did a still frame you can look at here, Rob. The king and Sir Branton, they have this look on their face just like, okay. But anyway, Sir Branton, he's still saying he's going to save Helaine. He says he does not care about the 7 curses. For Helaine, he would face 70 curses. And the king promises him that if he succeeds, he will receive half of his wealth and the princess's hand in marriage. Meanwhile, back at in the witch hole, George and Sybil have been watching all this in the magic mirror. I kind of forgot about them while the scene was going on, but I guess we've been watching what they are watching. And George is not happy. He's mad. He does not want Sir Branton to save Helaine. He does not want Sir Branton to marry Helaine. He's the one who loves her, even though they never met. So he begs Sybil to let him go rescue the princess. And Sybil is like, "Nonsense. You are only a child." So here we're about to get some backstory. First of all, we learn that 300 years ago, Sybil's father and brother were eaten by Lodak's dragon, and they were excellent sorcerers. So Lodak is far too dangerous for them to face. She says, "I fear him almost as much as I hate him." And after all, while Sybil is a sorceress who is hundreds of years old, George is a mortal and still a child. And we're also told that this is not framed as a revelation. It's just more like, as you know, George, when you were only a week old, your royal parents died of the plague, and then I took you in and raised you as my own son. And we learn that Sybil has been a kind and loving mother to George, but being an ancient sorceress, she doesn't get him because he's mortal. So she doesn't really understand that humans are not children at the age of 20.
Yeah, I mean, he's at a difficult age right now. But on the other hand, I think there's a lot of evidence to support the idea that Sybil has just had to do a lot of guesswork in how to raise a boy, a mortal boy. Like, he seems like maybe he hasn't been as exposed to like other kids growing up and into a wider world. He's had maybe a little bit too much access to magical items. Mm. And she's, as we'll see, you know, kind of spoiled him a bit, too. So, again, it makes for this, George ends up being this very weird hero in this picture because, you know, he doesn't have the same sort of origin story and trajectory that you would expect of your Dragon Slayer character. He's lived a very privileged in many ways upbringing, but also a very, it's been a lot of deprivation in his upbringing, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. Also, this is where we get the scene where he's moping, he's upset because of, you know, her denials here. And then she tries to cheer him up by turning into a panther, but she doesn't do anything. It's not like she turns into a panther and, I don't know, like spins plates on her head or something. She just is a panther and then she's not.
That should be enough. I can't do that.
That's true. I can't either. I don't, what am I gainsaying this for? Yeah, okay, she turns into a panther and doesn't do anything, but that's pretty impressive. But he says, "Mother, not that trick again."
Uh-huh.
like she's blowing raspberries on his belly or something. Anyway, this leads Sybil to take George on a, she takes him down into a kind of dungeon to show him the birthday presents she's going to give him next year when he turns 21. And these presents include a magical white stallion called Bayard that is faster than any horse on earth, a magical suit of armor that cannot be pierced by any weapon, and a magic sword that has a name. I was trying to hear what, I think it's called Escalon. Is that what
you
said?
Yeah, that sounds right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Escalon defies all swords in battle, neutralizes black magic, and it can open or close any door, portcullis, or portal with a touch.
So basically she's like, George, you're going to be a level one character, but I have three legendary magical items for you.
That's
just
right.
Right out of the gate. You're going to totally destroy these kobolds.
Yeah, he's a level one fighter with the saber of doors, I guess. Yeah. George just starts like groaning with pleasure when he holds the magic sword. He's like, oh, it feels like it's part of my own body. Also in the room, she just happens to mention, these are not presented as part of his birthday presents. It's just like, oh yeah, those six knight statues there against the wall. These are the six most valiant knights in the world, which were turned to stone by Sybil's brother, which makes me wonder, wait a minute, was Sybil's brother a good sorcerer or a bad one?
Yeah. It sounds like maybe he was the bad sort, because these are six noble knights that were evidently defeated, imprisoned, made eternal servants of this witchcraft family. Yeah, I think there's a lot to suggest that this is not a beneficial fate that was bestowed upon them.
But here, George comes up with a clever trick. He manages to trick Sybil into going down into an enchanted sub-basement to, I don't know what, he just to go down there and look at it, I guess. And then as soon as she goes down ahead of him, he taps the stone trap door of the access to this basement, and it closes behind her, trapping her inside. Now he's free to go save the princess.
Yeah, he so buries his mom alive so that he can go out and pursue his love.
Seems kind of cruel, yeah. But also they do, I feel like they drop a few things to emphasize that, like, oh, she is an immortal sorceress, so it's not like she's going to die of thirst down there or anything, but she still doesn't like it.
Mm. She's like, oh, you scamp.
So he then uses his sword to unfreeze the knights, because I guess they were frozen by black magic. And we're going to meet all the knights in the next scene, but they wake up, and then there's one with a French accent who is like, thank you. But here we go straight to another scene in the throne room of the castle, where at the beginning of the scene, it's just like a repeat of what we already saw. Like Sir Branton is promising to rescue the princess. But at this point he kneels in front of the king. He makes this solemn vow to rescue her. And the king is like, that's a strange ring with a picture of a dragon on it, Sir Branton. Well, let's not pay any attention to that. Mm-hmm. They are interrupted by George, who is now calling himself Sir George. He barges into the throne room. He's dressed in his magical armor. He's got his magical sword, and he is accompanied by his six unfrozen caveman lawyer knights. And they all introduce themselves and show off their accents. So we've got, and they're each like from a country of Europe. So the strange thing about this is it's not set in like an alternate land. It's not, you know, Middle Earth or something. It seems to be set in Christian Europe, in Earth. So we have Sir Denis of France. they say Denis. I don't know if that would be Denis in real life, but Sir Denis of France, Sir Pedro of Spain, Sir Patrick of Ireland, Sir Anthony of Italy, Sir James of Scotland, and Sir Ulrich of Germany. And they all sort of like say a hello in their accents. The German knight, Sir Ulrich, he looks at the king and he's like, Mein Kaiser!
And that's actually the voice of Paul Frees, the noted voice actor who worked on such things as The Bullwinkle Show, The Last Unicorn, and just tons of various animated shows of old. Like he was in, you know, The Return of the King, The Flight of Dragons, you know, the Frosty the Snowman specials and so forth.
Oh, I did not know.
Yeah, yeah. He's a frequent name in all of those.
Well, here we get some conflict because Sir George, he shows up, he stands next to Sir Branton. He's like, yeah, I'm also going to save the princess and I'm also going to marry her. And Sir Branton doesn't like this. He tries to fight George. George doesn't want to draw his sword. So Branton strikes first, but just ends up shattering his sword on George's magical armor. And eventually the king, he literally says, I like these knights. So he decides, well, they're all going to have to go save the princess together. They'll have to work together. George, the six knights, and the scheming creep, Branton.
Yeah, the king sort of reminds them here that, like, actually the important thing is saving her from the wizard. We're getting a little sidetracked in the whole, like, who should get to marry her thing.
Yeah, yeah. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Meanwhile, at Lodax Castle, we are going to check in with the princess now. Princess Helene is being taken to her cell, and there she meets a couple of other princesses who are sisters. And this scene sort of suggests that Lodak is running like a full-time princess dragon feeding operation. Like he's processing incoming princesses on a bi-weekly basis. So he always has some princesses in the hopper when he feeds the ones that have already been there to the dragon. So I think he's like seasoning them in the dungeon while the dragon eats the ones that have been there already.
Yeah. And it also makes me wonder, are there attached schemes for these princesses as well that result in some sort of revenue income or magical item income? It seems like a big operation because this is not some dusty old sorcerer. This man has a fabulous wardrobe. He has a big castle to upkeep. He has various pets and curses to take care of. You know, you got to stay busy to keep that afloat.
It is indicated that that he asks for ransom. He doesn't for Princess Helene because he says that she is a special case. But what we're led to believe is that normally, yeah, he's got princesses coming in all the time and he gets their king fathers to pay money. So these princesses think that they're going to be fine because their father will pay the ransom required to save them. Unfortunately, Lodak says their father did not pay up and instead he sent a company of knights to rescue them and the knights all died facing his seven curses. I have questions about this. Like, would there be enough princesses to sustain this kind of operation indefinitely? Like, how does Lodak not exhaust the supply of princesses at this rate?
I mean, maybe he's working internationally. We don't know. Like, he's just in Christian Europe, medieval Europe at this point, but maybe he's also jetting off to East Asia at times. He's heading to Africa and South America. Like, he's got a full global operation going here. Maybe he franchises.
I wonder if sometimes like he can't get a princess and it's just like, oh, this week I had to feed my dragon an earl. Anyway, Basil Rathbone tries to make Helene watch the other princesses being fed to the dragon, but she won't look and we don't get to see the monster yet. Then Lodak explains, hey, you know, there are some knights who are coming to rescue you, but don't worry, they will fail. First of all, he says, Sir Branton is coming, and she seems not excited by this prospect, so I guess she doesn't like him.
She's like, I'd like to be saved, but...
Yeah, not a big fan of Sir Brant here. But there's also somebody coming named Sir George, and despite having never met him and not knowing who he is, she's like, oh, George, sounds cool.
Yeah, and his main attraction being that he's not Sir Branton, I guess.
Oh, that's a good point. Maybe she's just excited that it's anybody but Sir Branton.
Yeah.
So Lodak is like, well, I'll show you the young fool. And then once again, we tune into magical remote surveillance TV. So like on a screen on the wall, Lodak shows George, Branton, and the other knights approaching the first curse. What is the first curse? Well, you know what? I really like the set and the landscape they set up here. It is quite creepy. So they go into this this landscape of strangely shaped trees that at first I was like, what are we looking at? It almost looks like trees that have been pulled up out of the ground and you can see the whole root structure around them in this pyramid shaped kind of structure. But no, I don't think that's what it is. I think it's actually supposed to be trees that have been knocked over in some way at like 10 feet up off the ground. But I got to give them credit. I really like this set. It does make me feel uneasy. What lives here? And then we find out it's an ogre. It's a big old ogre that starts trying to smash the knights. And also the ogre design, it's gross looking. It's creepy.
Yeah, this monster has obviously this is going to be something akin to Amazing Colossal Man. In terms of just being this giant humanoid. But yeah, also has this kind of like werewolfy wolfman quality to it. And also seems... I don't know. I ended up feeling more sorry for this creature than anything because he doesn't really do much. He just kind of stands there and howls while knights attempt to murder him.
He's got like one thing that looked creepy to me about him is that it's like he's got different kinds of teeth in his mouth. So they're not just like a row of sharp teeth. It's like he has teeth from three different kinds of creatures all in the same mouth.
This may also be the character I've read. I think Michael Weldon points out that Richard Kiel is in this movie, but is completely uncredited. This would seem to be the role you would have him in if you had an uncredited Richard Kiel.
Oh, I wonder. But I know what you're saying about feeling sad for the creature, because it almost does seem like he's just trying to hang out in this little blasted landscape here. And then these things come in and start poking at him with spears. And
yeah, he didn't know what's up.
Yeah.
He didn't ask to be the first curse. Maybe, so I mean, that's the thing. He's somebody who is cursed.
Yeah, that's true. So there's a long battle scene. George eventually defeats the ogre by galloping in circles around him on his magically fast horse. And the ogre is trying to like follow him in order to crush him. But he goes round and round in circles. And then the ogre becomes dizzy and falls over. And then George pokes him in the heart with his sword.
Yeah, can't be that satisfying of a victory, honestly.
Oh, and some of the knights are killed here. So Sir Ulrich and Sir Pedro are killed by the ogre, and they have a little funeral for them and show them being buried. And Sir Branton skips the funeral. He's scouting ahead. Meanwhile, there are just like some scenes in the castle where Helene is running around. She like sneaks out of her cell and is running around getting scared by various things. One of which is shrunken people inside a cage. There's like doll sized people in a little cage saying, "Help us, help us," like Attack of the Puppet People.
Yep.
Lodak's castle also has like these like blue ghouls and guys with conical heads and people in plague doctor like bird masks and just various people being scary.
Yeah, but mostly cone heads. There are a lot of cone heads.
So on the road, the knights travel on to the next curse, which is a vile, misty swamp full of bubbling acid pools. In this swamp, the knights become separated from one another, and Sir Anthony falls into a bubbling acid pool. George tries to go save him, and Branton intentionally knocks George into the pool. Somehow George doesn't realize this later. I don't know if he thinks it was an accident or he doesn't realize somebody kicked him. I'm not sure.
But the result is pretty gruesome because we don't get, you might expect from a movie like this, you might expect it to be like that high school biology classroom skeleton rising to the surface. No, what we get is a bit grimmer.
It's like a skull with very bleached white gritted teeth. And then where the flesh would be over the skull is just like bubble gum has been stretched over the bone.
Mm-hmm. But the bubble gum that's had all the flavor chewed out of it.
Oh, yeah. It's nasty looking. And it happens like immediately. Like Anthony's, he's like swimming in the pool, going being like, "Help, help." And then it cuts away and then cuts back. And now he's just the skull.
Done for. Fatality.
But George survives the acid pool, I think, because of his magical armor. I assume that's the reason.
Hmm. Yeah, he's indestructible in this stuff.
Now, meanwhile, back at the witch hut, Sybil finally escapes the basement. She realizes, and her friends there in the witch hole are like playing chess. She realizes George is in danger. So she decides she has to intervene to save him. But first, she's going to watch him on magic TV. We see her watching in the magic mirror the camp of the knights after Anthony also has died. So now there are only three of the other knights left. I think Sir James of Scotland, Sir Patrick of Ireland, and Sir Denis of France. And at the camp, Sir Branton is giving a speech trying to convince the other knights to abandon the journey. He's like, "Go home, you know, you don't have to risk your lives anymore." But the other knights refuse. And Sir Patrick mocks him. He says his tongue is like the honey from a clover patch. Is that an expression? I've never heard that.
I've only ever heard it in this movie.
So while the other knights sleep, Sir Branton sneaks off alone to a house in the countryside, all for an illicit rendezvous with Lodak. So here we get a big twist. Turns out they have been conspiring together from the beginning. Remember that that ring with a dragon on it that Sir Branton had and the king noticed and then nobody said anything about? So it works like this. Lodak lost his magic ring a while back. Sir Branton found it. Lodak wants the ring back, but he can't take it because the ring protects itself against being taken by force. So they make a deal. In exchange for the return of the ring, Lodak will help Sir Branton win the hand of Princess Helene and the reward of half of the king's kingdom for her rescue. So he would do that by staging this abduction and then allowing Sir Branton to bring her back.
I love it. Yeah, a nice side scheme to everything here. The plot thickens.
It is a good twist. And but clearly the party, one thing I like about it is that they're not just cleanly in league. Like the parties involved here distrust one another. Mm-hmm. They are both snakes and they're both wondering how will the other one try to betray me?
Right. Yeah. Either one will stab the other one in the back once they have what they want.
Oh, and then suddenly while they're talking, Lodak is like, "Oh, Sir Denis of France is coming." You know, so Sir Denis noticed Branton leaving the camp early in the morning and he followed him to investigate while everybody else is sleeping. Lodak detects he's coming, but don't worry, he has a plan. It's some kind of horrible love trap. Like he sees Sir Denis coming and then he's like, "Aha, he's a Frenchman. And so I will get him with a pretty woman." So suddenly while Denis is approaching this house that he's trying to investigate, just like a pretty lady just wanders onto the screen, singing Frère Jacques. Mm-hmm. And Sir Denis is like, there can't be anything suspicious about this.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just like, Monomore, I'm in love. He is successfully catfished by magic. I guess you would call this witch fished. And so he's like, they're just sitting there smooching. And then suddenly she transforms into a witch and tries to bite his neck. And the witch has like, the witch is creepy looking. She's got like one eye melting off of her head. She tries to bite him in the neck, but Sir George comes to the rescue. Dennis is saved because George does something like with his magic shield, and it like emits light that scares the witch and makes her vaporize. Oh, and then I like how Dennis is, he just fully plays into the Lodak assumed stereotype here. When he's talking to George, he's like, yeah, Lodak got me. He must have known I was French.
I mean, it's enough to make you wonder, are these knights even real? Were they really captured knights, or were they just made by sorcery and therefore based on just broad stereotypes?
That's funny, yeah. And then there's a confrontation where George and Dennis go into the house to see Sir Branton, but Branton lies his way out of it. And there's also, after they leave, there's a funny scene where the witch, like they have a performance review, the witch does with Lodak, and she's like, I almost killed him. I tried.
But you know that's not going to cut it. So what does he do? Bam, turns her into a spider.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, so how far into the curses are we now, Joe?
This is a good question. I sort of got confused trying to count the curses. So the ogre is the first curse, and the swamp with the acid pools, I think that's the second curse.
Okay, we're at least two in.
Third curse is, I think, the witch who looks like a French lady.
Yeah, okay. So that would mean we're ready for four at this point.
But when I think about the rest, it doesn't add up. I'm like, what are the seven curses?
Well, the next one is definitely a doozy.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah. Okay. So at this point, I think Sir James of Scotland and Sir Dennis of France, like, go ahead to investigate what's down the road. And that leaves Sir George, Sir Branton, and Sir Patrick of Ireland. And the three of them, they're approaching their comrades, but the comrades who went ahead are now just like melted. They're horribly irradiated, covered in blisters. Their hair is gone. Their skin is like peeling away like old wallpaper. It is it's disgusting, absolutely disgusting. You see them in like a cave, I think, staring into this yellow spiral, and they're shirtless and their hair is gone. And then they turn and look into the camera and they're all messed up, partially melted. And then you see their like silhouettes coming over a hilltop, and then they just disappear. It's like they turn to dust.
Yeah, in a way, almost like a decade-appropriate version of the RoboCop melt scene, you know, because it's like they're coming right at us. They look horrible. They look in pain. And it's this moment, especially, where I can think, I can rationalize. It's like, okay, I could see where some censors might have had a problem with the tonal inconsistency of this film. One second, it's a chimpanzee playing chess, and then later on, it's this.
Yeah. Can't you just imagine Sir Branton here in Ray Wise fashion being like, don't touch me, man.
Yeah.
All right. So those knights, they're gone, melted, blasted by whatever that the yellow spiral thing was. Now, somewhere in here, this may actually have already happened, or it's somewhere in here that there's a whole scene where Sybil back at home is trying to intervene to help George. She wants to like brew up a potion and do a spell that will help him somehow, but she ends up having the exact opposite of her intended effect, and she accidentally disables his magic powers instead.
This is the Sybil is cooking scene that I referenced earlier, and yeah. Even though it doesn't pay off for her, it's still a fabulous sequence, because again, the music just gets super weird. You got those red gels, and yeah, she's just cooking away, and I love it.
And you could tell she's improvising, like she doesn't remember the recipe. So she's, you know, it's like she's playing a solo here, making it up as she goes. I think I need the ears of a rabbit. That's right. That's it.
Yeah, she doesn't have the recipe in front of her. She doesn't have everything prepared. But oh, man, her cauldron is an upturned monster skull.
Yeah, that's good.
So I love everything about this sequence, even if it doesn't really pay off the way she's hoping it will.
So after this, Sir Branton leads George and Sir Patrick of Ireland, the last of the six knights, into a cave. And then he like leads them into the cave. I can't remember. He kind of like taunts them somehow and makes them follow him. Mm-hmm. And then they go into the cave, and then he leaves the cave, and the door of the cave closes behind him. So they're trapped inside. And then these weird green mask ghosts come out. They're like floating in the air and wailing. And one of the ghosts kills Sir Patrick sort of just by flying into his face and then seeping into him.
Yeah, it's kind of a hard to follow sequence, but the ghosts are creepy. The music is good. The ghosts kind of look like shrunken heads and, like you said, also like masks. So, it mostly works.
It does. The one thing that works less well is the tone of what follows. So Sir Patrick dies and he can be heard violently screaming, George, help me. It's like really painful to hear, ragged screaming, desperate. Mm-hmm. But then a ghost face flies into the wall of the cave and a door opens to the outside. So like they were trapped inside. Oh, and George had tried to use his sword to open the door because it's supposed to open any doors, but it has been deactivated from afar by Sybil. So that didn't work. And so, yeah, this ghost face flies into the wall. The wall opens up yet again. And then the voice of Sir Patrick, still screaming in exactly the same way, says, George, through the wall.
Yeah. And it's hard to follow exactly what has happened here. And which character is it that then tells us in a bit here and explains that, oh, well, it's Patrick's faith.
Lodak explains it actually. Oh, yeah. So George escapes the cave because of whatever that was, the like face flying into the wall and the screaming voices, door open, George gets out. And there's this lingering shot of Sir Patrick's dead body in the cave as the wall closes behind George on his way out. Then we see once again, somebody watching magic remote TV, Lodak and Sir Branton are looking upon a magic fire scheming, and Sir Branton says, was it magic? Lodak says, no, not magic. Sir Branton says, then how did George escape? Lodak says, I think, yes, something stronger than magic. The power of Patrick's faith.
Yeah, like where does that come from? We have not, there's been nothing to establish that Patrick was particularly religious. All we know is that he is Irish. And he doesn't even like call out to God or Jesus or anything during that final encounter. Like that alone would have been if he was like, Jesus Christ, save our hero or something, anything. But no, it's just apparently his faith was strong enough that God intervened, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. Very strange. But I think it's funny that Lodak acknowledges that his powers are helpless in the face of like prayer. So if his enemies would just like pray to God to defeat him, they could win.
Or I guess he's kind of like, well, God only gets involved directly on rare occasions. So it's going to happen every now and then, but not to the extent that it's going to actually derail my plans here.
Yeah. So anyway, this seems to be the last of the seven curses somehow, or maybe there's one still at the castle. Something like George gallops up to.
There's no way we're past five here. This has to be
I don't know. Where are the others? George gallops up to the castle on his white horse. And as he wanders through the deserted courtyard, a heavy wooden door creaks open by itself to allow him inside. And Lodak and Branton, they know he's here. They're watching as he heads towards Helaine's cell. And Lodak says, don't worry about it, Sir Branton. It'll all work out just fine. So George gets to Helaine's cell. He greets her. Helaine says, George? Oh, I must be dreaming. But you are George. Or is this just more of Lodak's magic? And I guess he has to be like, hi, you know, I've been spying on you in the magic pool for years, but we have not met. but she is happy to see him. And there's some type of parody here because she says Lodak has been showing her visions of him just to torture her. So they like both only know one another from magical remote surveillance. And this is the first time either one has seen the other in person. They start smooching, of course. There's kissing there. And what about Sir Branton? Who cares? So they try to sneak out. But just as they are able to reach the front door, Lodak springs a trap. His weird minions magically materialize in front of the exit. And George and Helaine are caught. Sir Branton's treachery is revealed. Branton, thinking that the deal has been finished, gives the magical ring back to Lodak, and then Helaine says she will happily leave with Sir Branton. Huh? I thought she didn't really like him. Why is she so happy to go with him? I mean, I guess it would kind of make sense. She'd be happy to leave with anybody, but, you know, it's surprising to the viewer. But guess what? It's another double cross. We sort of saw this coming, didn't we? You can't trust Lodak. Captured well in this production still that I drug up, Rob. So Sir Branton is like embracing Helaine, and it's the witch double cross again. Hagged again.
But he's not going to get off that easy.
No, of course not. No, Lodak says, did you really think I'd keep my word once I had the ring? And Branton seems genuinely shocked and betrayed. Did you notice, like, it's weird how, like, surprised he seems by this?
But I made a deal with an evil wizard.
Yeah, it's like, and we already even talked about this. Like, how does, I don't know. But Sir Branton says, she belongs to me. We made a bargain. And Lodak says, I don't bargain with mortals. I destroy them. And then we get the magical destruction of Branton. What does Lodak do to him? Does he summon an ogre to crush him like a grape? Does he create another heat tornado to melt his flesh away? No, he transforms Sir Branton into a mounted head on the wall, like a stuffed deer head at a hunting lodge.
And the effect is pretty funny here.
Yes, it does look funny.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not even sure it's not just the actor sticking his head through a hole in the wall.
It might have been. It might have been that simple. Or it might have been some optical special effects that, especially to a modern viewer, you know, we're liable to miss because we take that sort of thing for granted.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back at home, we see more of Sybil trying to help George. She is trying to remember the words to a spell that she knows she could use to save George and defeat Lodak, but she can't remember the words. She knows there's like a number of lines and they all rhyme with sack, I think, and she can't remember the last word in the last line. Turns out it is attack. I think the last line, when she finally does remember it later, it's help my son to attack. It seems like that'd be kind of obvious, but
magic's complicated.
It's true. She decides to transform into a bird and fly to Lodak's castle, and she's going to figure out the spell on the way. So
at Lodak's castle, Lodak brings Helene to a dungeon room where George is shirtless and tied to a rack. Mm-hmm. And he's this part's creepy.
Lodak, I love this part. Yep.
Yeah, he's like, show me what young mortals in love do to bid farewell before they die. So I think he just wants to watch them make out a little.
Yeah, yeah, and mock them. But he's like 2 feet away from them, maybe.
Yes, he's standing right there, and they're smooching. And then he's like, how tender. too bad, it's too late for love. Now you're going to die. So they both say they love each other. And George is, the plan is he's going to have to watch through the window as Helene is fed to the dragon, much like she was supposed to watch as the other princesses were fed to the dragon.
Now, have we had the part where Lodak and Sybil have their final Zoom conference with each other and he destroys her mirror? We may have skipped over that, but
I'm sorry. I think I forgot to mention that scene. Yes.
It's wonderfully spicy because it's like Lodak calls in on the magic mirror and he's like, Sybil, you're looking old. And it's like it's just off to a really toxic start between these two. And they kind of talk trash to each other. And then he destroys her mirror and he's like, you're not going to interfere with my plans.
Oh, but Lodak's in for a surprise. Mm-hmm. So we get a scene of Lodak's minions preparing a feast, and one of them is supposed to go get the cage of shrunken people, like the puppet people, to put in the stew, but he drops the cage and they escape, and it's a repeat of Attack of the Puppet People. It's literally like the shrunken people get out and start like setting up traps and wreaking havoc within the room.
It's nice. They condensed all of that into a short segment in a much better film.
Yeah, yeah. So the puppet people, for some reason, they break into George's cell and they bring him his magic sword and they use it to cut the ropes that are binding our hero. They set him free. George thanks them. He tells them that even though the sword has lost its magic, it's still a sword.
It's like an escalator, when it breaks down, like Mitch Hedberg pointed out. Still stairs.
That's a good point. The dragon is coming to eat Helene. She's, tied up there for the dragon to eat. She's screaming in terror. And you know what? I'm going to say this dragon looks surprisingly good. I would say actually shockingly good for a Burt I. Gordon movie. This is without a doubt the best looking special effect I've ever seen from Mr. Big.
Absolutely. Looks amazing. Obviously you see it in motion, that it's an effect, but it is very well done and it's shooting flames. It looks dangerous and wild. Yeah.
So it's like a big two-headed dragon breathing fire. It has frills on its heads. And George comes in on his horse. He's trying to save Helene, squaring off against the dragon with his lance. And then Sybil arrives. She like parks next to Lodak, who is looking down from above on a parapet. And Lodak says, Sybil, come to watch your boy die. But Sybil, she's busy trying to remember the next line of the spell to restore George's magic. I got to say, in the performance here, she does not seem to have the appropriate sense of urgency. She's still just doing her kind of absent-minded, only half present. What was that next line? But eventually, she does come up. She doesn't just remember it. Lodak cues her. Mm-hmm. Lodak sees that George's magical weapons are not working against the dragon. And Lodak says, he's even lost the power to attack. And then Sybil's like, oh, that's the word. Attack. Give my boy the power to attack. And so now I guess he's powered up once again. Oh, and then while Lodak is distracted, Sybil steals Lodak's ring. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm a little foggy on how it works, though, because we were told earlier it couldn't be taken by force, but I guess it can be slipped off while you're looking the other way. So. Wizard grease on your fingers there.
Now, Lodak doesn't consider himself defeated yet. She takes his ring, but he says, they will still die. I curse you. Curse upon curse. And so George, here's how the math works out. Now that I'm remembering it, I think the dragon itself is the sixth curse. Okay. And then Lodak explains that the seventh curse is himself, is Lodak. Mm.
That's fitting. Yeah.
So Lodak seems ready to blast out some kind of killing magic. But then in a fantastic payoff to what seemed like a really pointless setup that we were even making fun of earlier, Sybil turns into a panther and mauls Lodak, killing him. It's George's favorite trick when he was a boy.
And now it's paid off once more. It's great. It's a great moment when Sybil gets her comeuppance here. Because, again, Lodak has not considered her a threat at all the entire time. And now she has completely defeated him. For George, I guess. You know, George is the hero. I don't know. I feel like Sybil's the hero.
I mean, Sybil does most of the work. Like, she enchants all of the items that allow George to defeat these monsters and stuff. Mm-hmm. I would say the craftiest thing that George does of his own accord is actually when he tricks Sybil into going in the basement at the beginning and traps her there.
That's right. And his most cunning move.
It is. And most of his equipment does the rest.
Yeah. Which again, she supplied.
But anyway, okay. So all is restored. All is happy now. And we go back to the castle where the king is, and Helene and George have returned, and it seems like the king approves of George now. So of course they're going to get married. Somehow the six knights are alive again. They just are shown walking into the throne room. I don't think there's any explanation of how they're not dead. Did you pick up anything there?
I kind of I was thinking about this, and I was like, oh, I guess it's because, you know, Sybil's brother, whenever he froze them, like, he made them his sorceress slaves forever. So it's like, you guys are not getting out of this just because you died horribly in this quest. Like, no. Sybil, you belong to Sybil forever, and you have to serve her son or whoever happens to have the reins here.
It's like a warlock pact. It's like, even if you die, you're in Avernus, and you still have to serve the warlock, the patron.
Yeah. They still seem upbeat about it, but I don't think they have any choice in the matter.
Well, who's complaining? We get to hear all those wonderful accents again. And and then Sybil's also hanging out in the throne room. I guess she's like the court sorceress now. She's going to heal the king's pink eye. I think that's about as happy an ending as one could ask for.
It's really the rise of Sybil too, because she's going to basically be running the place. I was not super impressed by the king. Sybil is totally ruling this kingdom now. There's a huge power vacuum left by the death of Lodak. So yeah, this is the reign of Sybil day one.
I agree with that. The king's previous most decisive moments were things like, I like these knights.
Yeah. More belly dancing, please.
Yeah. Well, I pledge fealty to Lady Sybil. May she reign for 10 million years.
All right. Well, this one was a really fun one. I encourage everyone out there to see this one. If you're a fan of the old MST3K version or the newer Rift tracks, yeah, do that. It's a great film to enjoy Rift, but it also more than stands up on its own. And again, if you do seek it out to watch it in the best quality you can get your hands on. All right. Just a reminder that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But here on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. If you want to see a list of all the movies we've covered over the years, you can go over to letterboxd.com. That's letterboxd.com. Our username is Weird House. We have an ongoing list of all the movies we've covered so far. And sometimes a peek ahead at what's coming up next. We're currently, if the math is all right, all correct here, this was 148. So we're almost to 150.
Wow, how time goes by.
Yeah.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.